accession number 16808, Rule 35.
Red Spittle's Rule 35.
So on this thing itself, I got demobbed in January 46, so we're in the winter time, you see, so I knew that when I got home, one of the things I would need for fishing would be my top coat, you see, so I said to him, oh, I should pay the pain to keep me coat, you see. So he said, is it any good? I said, no, it's a bit manky, I said, but be better than nothing anyway. He said, come around the stores, so I'll kick you out with a new one, so he gave me a brand new one, you see. Now the funny thing was, but as the war went on, all this brass and metal badges were being replaced by plastic ones, which was a good practical thing because, I mean, you get a tank berry on and you've got a tank badge on, which is quite large. It must have made a nice target when the sun caught it and put a shine on it for the German to aim at, I thought, you know. And, of course, they started bringing out these plastic badges. Exactly the same in every respect, except they were plastic, so of course they were dull. And depending on the regiments, depended whether they were brown or black. You see, you get the infantry, the rifle brigade people, they all their stuff was black. And the others was sort of just brown plastic, you see. Well, when I got this coat, they were plastic buttons. Exact the same as the brass ones, with the coat of arms on and everything. So no difference in the size and all that, except they were plastic, a brown plastic. Which means you didn't have to clean. I thought, and that's bloody marvellous. I goes in 1939, I have to wait till 1945 before I get a top coat, I don't have to clean the buttons. And of course, I always had brass buttons. And anyway, it was a brand new top coat, and a matter of fact, I only got rid of it about 2 years ago with a friend who is a collector of army stuff, he's an enthusiast. And he was overjoyed to have this army top coat of mine because one of the things in it they'd put in was that one of these buttons, the big ones, was in fact a compass, you see. And you used to screw the top off and there was a little compass inside and it was still there. I mean, a lot of people had lost them or whatever, you see. But this one, being a brand new coat, when I had it, it was still there, you see. And anyway, I say I got rid of it about... It was worn out, totally worn out, you know, but he didn't mind that because I got my number stenciled in inside in the guys. Inside these top coats was a khaki cloth loose piece across the shoulders inside the khaki top coat itself, you see. And on that's a piece where you used to stencil your number and your name for in case you know, sort of want to identify, you see. So I did the job properly, got my top coat, put my name and number in, you see, with the stencils. And he was overjoyed with it a couple of years ago when he was talking. I said, well, I've still got my old top coat, you see. And he said, oh, it's a load of rubbish now. The cuffs are gone, the pockets are worn out and all that, you see. But he was overjoyed to receive it. So it went to a good home at the finish. So I got a brand new top coat, you see, and proceeded onwards. And it was a good pound, that was. Well, when I get to Calais, the final stage, I ran into my old friend Jack Smith, who, if you've listened to the previous ones, he was an old terrier, the same as I was posted out to the Middle East, and he was nicknamed K-Boy because he was bow-legged, terribly bow-legged as a kid, and he always had this swagger when he walked because of his bow legs, you see, and he was always sort of making out he was a K-Boy when we was kids, you see, because we all used to have pistols when we was kids from the junk shops.
What's a K-boy?
An ordinary American K-boy, so he used to sort of walk as though he's riding...
A cowboy?
K-boy, as though he's on a horse, you see, with his bow legs. And so it was nicknamed right from school days, K-boy Smith, you see. And he lived in Kingsthorpe Hollow, where I lived, so I knew him at school and knew him all my life, sort of thing. And he was posted out in the Middle East. And as I've recounted earlier, when we was disbanded from the Yeomanry, and we went to join the 1st Royal Tank Regiment, my troop arrived there in the dark, and we saw these tanks. When I went across to the nearest one, it turned out to be Jack Smith. He said, okay, boy. And then, of course, we stayed the night, and the next day we moved on into the regiment, and I never saw him again. And until I goes to Calais for me demob, and sure enough, up pops Jack. And he was a collector, one of these people. You've got these people who collected, and what he collected wasn't to do anything to do with the home or life. It was just souvenirs, you see. And he was carrying this parcel. It'd be about 4.5 feet long, and quite large in circumference, all wrapped up, the rope round it and whatever, so it was a bundle. And I said, bloody hell, you got in there, Jack? He said, swords and daggers. And there were all these German swords and daggers, beautiful things they were, with swastikas on them and eagles and all sorts of, you know. And when we got home, he still lived in down Semelon, where I came from, and he was married, same as I was, and he put them up in his front room, and he got some chain from somewhere, and he put them like a V, with the smallest ones at the bottom and the largest ones at the top, all the way down the wall in his front room. And his wife was going mad about it, you know. She didn't think much of it at all, but Jack did. And but like, at the time, people didn't, they were worth it, so just souvenirs. But of course, years later, they'd be very, very valuable, what he's got. Oh, Jack, it was really wonderful, some of these stilettos and dress daggers and that, you know, wonderful things they were. Anyway, that's what he was carrying, you see. And I got my suitcase with me bits and bobs in. And it's funny, because I never seemed to have any luck in like buying draw tickets for sweeps and things like that, you know. And one of the things was, when we got to Calais, we were stuck there for 2 days while they was waiting for these numbers to come. So everything was numbered, you see, and air group was number 25, and I understood that the demobilisation group of 25 was the largest individual group of people of the demob series, because it fell into that age bracket. You see, when I got called up, I was 21 on the Tuesday. I was mobilised on the Friday at the drill hall on the September the 1st, and the war started on September the 3rd on the Sunday, and I was 21. And so I was older than a lot of the young terriers who joined, these young lads. I didn't realise that until later years, really. So you've got an age group of sort of basically 19, 20, 21, perhaps 22. And that was, if you'd have took that, when I joined the Terriers in 1939, in the spring, if you'd have took the group, the age of all those hundreds of lads that joined when I joined, those 3 years would have been the big group amongst those several hundreds of lads, you see. So, of course, the repercussions were passed on, so that when you was going to be demobbed, that still happened right the way through the forces, you see. And so it embraced this group 25, and they reckon it was the largest personal group of the demobilisation organisation. Anyway, which meant that when we got down to Calais, the place was absolutely jam-packed with blokes waiting to be demobbed, you see. And I suppose they'd only got so much transport backwards and forwards across the channel. And so we were stuck there for a couple of days, you see. Well, you've got to look around for entertainment, and they was running a housey-housey, like the old bingo thing, you see, in one of the canteens. And there was a sergeant major and a couple of his oppos were running it. And of course, because there were so many there, they just didn't run one set of cards. They was running three sets of cards, you see. So when they got a house, you got three. And of course, with all the hundreds of blokes there, and you paid so much in to go in it, there was all this money. And it wasn't just one currency, it was whatever the blokes had got in the pocket from wherever they'd come from. And I mean, some had probably come from Italy or whatever, you say, or Austria and all that. So whoever won it, they got all this foreign currency of all mixed up nations, you see. Anyway, I'm getting there with me, got me bits of paper on the numbers, you see, and suddenly I've got a house. So I said, house, and these other two chaps' house. And because they didn't want to delay getting the next lot moving, when you went up to collect your doings and looked at your ticket, they used to say, well, card or low card. And what they used to do, you see, was cut the cards to see which one of those three had the money. It was, rather than sharing it out three ways, you see. And because you were coming home, it was really no good to you, see. It was all foreign money. You wasn't going to be able to spend it because you were coming to England, you see. And there he was with this pile of money. So he said, well, again, I or low. So I said, I or low, one of the two. And I won it. first time I think I'd ever won anything in my life like that, you know. And I got all this money, so I just got my berry, scooped it all in my berry, and that was notes and coins and all sorts, you see, and weighed about a ton. So of course I goes back and sorting out, and they got a racket going. Another lot, it's, you know, this black market and rackets were rife. I think it was going on all over the world actually. But and what they were doing, as we were coming home for demob, there was also intakes coming over, chaps who had been called up from the trainer regiments, replacing us chaps on the continent, you see. So what they got, this racket, they got it organised, and one part were greeting these chaps with in common, and they'd all got English money on them of some sort, some quantity, some have got more than others, and what they were after was the pound notes and the 10 shilling notes, you see. And they got an exchange rate going, so as soon as these lads came in, they got to come into the canteens, and these touts would go round, you see, and say, you got the English money, mate? And he'd say, yeah, I've got 5 quid or something like that. And they'd say, where are you going, you know? And they already knew where they were going, where they were going to stay in France, Belgium, Holland, Germany, you see. And they'd say, right, well, you want some money when you get there. And, you know, so they'd say, we'll do an exchange rate. So they'd exchange the German currency, whichever it was, for the English money that they got in the pockets, you see. So then they were coming over the other way, and air people wanted to buy English money, you see. Well, they were giving them an extortion rate for the incoming money and a same extortion rate for the outgoing, because, I mean, air chaps had got all this money, which was going to be no good to them, only as souvenirs. So they were willing to give, so that if for a pound note, you perhaps give them a sort of £30 value in foreign currency, you see, because it was going to be no good to you. So they got the best of both worlds, you see, and all won this out, see, and I got all this money. I thought, Christ, what am I going to do with all that? And, of course, we were sharing these canteens with these incoming lads, and I said to one of these lads, I said, you got any English money? And he got some with him, so I said, you want to swap it for some of this foreign money? He said, well, how much are you going to give me, like, you see? So I just told, and I was giving like an extortion rate, really. I was liberally handing out this foreign money to get pound notes or 10 shilling notes to come back to England, you see. And it's a good job I was only there 2 days. I was thinking about my throat cut otherwise, because it soon dawned on these people there was somebody somewhere was undermining their system, you see, because they were going around and lads say make money, and they'd say, well, I've already changed it, you see. And they didn't know who was changing it, you know, because they'd got the system tied up, as they thought. And of course, it finished up, this bloke came round to me, he said, you're the bloke, are you? He said, who's changing all this money? I said, yeah, what about it? He said, well, you want to pack it up, you see. Well, what he didn't know, I'd still got my Luger, you see, which I was thinking of a souvenir, you see. So I said, well, I said, if you want to die a natural death, mate, I said, you can, I said, because I'd just as soon as shoot you as I said I would have done the Germans. So I said, you better get on your way, like you say. But of course, if I'd have been there longer, they would have probably had me, like. And so I finished up with, I don't know, about £50 or £60 of English money before I left Calais, you see. I got rid of a lot of my stuff, but we've still got a lot of it even now. We've got a tin full of foreign money upstairs, coins, and we've got a wallet full of paper money, you know, sort of 100 marks and all that sort of stuff. And some of it is Polish and that, you know, which was still used as currency, like, you know. And let's say we've got a wallet upstairs with all this, it's only like souvenir paper money, you see. But that's what I did, you know, and so I sort of got a bit of a start when I got home for my demob money, which didn't amount to a lot, really. And anyway, when we started then to come back, and we get on the ferry to come over, you notice all these chaps with all these things that they were bringing back that they thought would be useful and sort of unobtainable in England. One bloke who got a motorbike, of all things, pushing it, and he, I don't know where he come from, but he got this motorbike he was bringing over, and nobody seemed to bother, you know. There was no authority saying you can't take that. And there was another bloke got a pram, big old-fashioned prams they were in those days. He got a pram. And chaps had got all sorts of things that they were bringing and carrying. And old Jack had got this bundle of swords and daggers, you see. And we gets on the boat and we're coming over, and we wasn't long after we got out into the channel that the tannoy started warning everybody about offensive weapons, you see. And what they really meant was revolvers and things like that. And initially nobody took any notice, you see. But then as you got sort of halfway across, the sort of the tannoy was saying it was, wasn't a threat, but it began to point out that if you were caught at Dover carrying sort of weapons, it was possible that you, the redcaps would wheel you in, you see, and you wouldn't stop you being demobbed, but it probably may you be delayed for as long as it took for them to sort you out, like you say, which, I don't know, perhaps could have been weeks. So, of course, the main thing is to get home. So the nearer we got to Dover, the more stuff was going over the side of the ferry, you see. And I was still hanging on to my Luger. And at the finish, I thought, well, that ain't worth it. So I tossed it over the side. And I think the last few miles of the channel from outside of Dover, there must be like an arsenal of weapons on in the seabed and it's rusting away. And so that's where my Luger went, you see, over the side, just outside Dover. And when we came off the boat, all I'd got was my suitcase, you see. And everything else had gone, had been handed in at various stages. And Jack had got this big thing. Well, as they're coming off, they were, the red caps were checking, not too seriously. And this one said to old Jack, he said, what do you got there then? Old Jack said, not to worry, mate, he's only got a couple of spandos. And old machine guns. And this bloke looked at him, he said, and I don't think he was quite sure about it. He looked at him, he said, give us it here. And old Jack handed it over, and he just held it, you see. Well, he knew from the weight that there certainly wasn't any machine guns in there. It wasn't heavy enough, you see. But old Jack, I thought he was a sort of bugger, you know, because, I mean, it could have quite easily wheeled him away and made him undo it all to see exactly what he had got, like, you see. And then when they found all these swords and things, I mean, they might even have said they were offensive weapons. And but anyway, he said, give us it here, and he held it in his arms. Go on, he said, bugger off, you know. And so Jack got through with all his swords and daggers, and he got them hanging on his wall he had. But eventually he left the town a few years after the war. He went to Leicester or somewhere. I've never seen him since. But so then, of course, we came to Dover, and they put us on a train, and we came up to Bletchley Park, where the Enigma thing was recently publicised. And a lot of the huts that were there, you see, which have been used, and now become surplus to requirement, and they've made them, put double bunks in, you see, and all that, and made them into a part of it, into a sort of a staging post, you see. And we got off a train and some trucks, and we went into the Bletchley Park overnight. And a funny thing happened there, because by now you're beginning to see people who you know by sight from before the war, you see, and because you get nearer home. And I goes in and I looks around for a spare bed, and I puts me stuff up. There was a top bunk, and puts me stuff on the top, gets me kit out, and goes off. First thing you've got to look for is a cup of tea and a wad, you know, in a canteen somewhere. And when I comes back, the chap who got the bunk underneath, he was there, he'd just been out of washing shave, and when he stood up, it was a chap named Freddie Hope, who I knew from pre-war, from the fishing days, you see, he was a fisherman. And I said, hello, Fred. And strange enough, he didn't remember me. I mean, we'd been in the circles of fishing fraternity in the town. I mean, we knew each other very familiarly before the war. And because now, it was sort of 6 years or so later, and whether... I didn't feel I'd changed in any way particularly, but anyway, he didn't seem to remember. You know, I said who I was, not, and oh well, he said, you know, and that was that. And after the war, I eventually joined St James Working Men's Club, which was Fred's club, you see. He lived down Jimmy's End, as we called it. And he wasn't very communicative generally, but when he'd had a couple of beers, he sometimes would reminisce a bit, you see, and get a bit soft, like, you know. And we, because by now we'd become friends, and I was talking, I said to him about it, I reminded him about this incident, and he couldn't even remember the incident happening. You know, it's strange how you remember some trivial things quite vividly, And then something that ought to be a bit more important, you can't always recollect it at all, you see. Anyway, I reminded him, and he come back. So I said, "So where'd you been then, Fred?" So he said, "Oh, down in the desert." He said, "You know," and he wasn't a very big lad, old Fred. He'd been older than me, but he wasn't very big, and he'd been a good runner in his time before the war, and short distance, you know, 100 yards. He was a good runner locally, and I said, "But what was you in then, Fred?" So he was a medic. I said, "Oh, well, yeah." He said, "Yeah." I said, "A bit of a gruesome job, wasn't it?" He said, "Well, it was at times, Reg." He said, "But I chose to do that," he said, "you know." So I said, "What, in the mob, you mean?" He said, "Well, no." He said, "You see, I'm a pacifist." He said, "But I'm not brave enough to tell anybody." He said, "I'm a coward." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, when I got called up, went for me medical and all that, and register. And it got to the point," he said, "where I was going to be going. I told him, "Oh, don't mind wearing the uniform. I'll go anywhere you send me, but I won't carry arms." And the bloke said, "You're a conscientious objector." Oh, Fred said, "Oh, no, I'm not a conscientious objector," he said. "I'm not brave enough." He said, "I'm not brave enough to walk about the streets in civvies and people say he's a country." He said, "But I don't mind being in the forces. I'll wear the uniform. I'll go wherever you send me. But I won't carry arms. I won't kill anybody." He said, "I said, that was a... I mean, you had some hard times over that, didn't you, Fred?" "Not really," he said, "because only in the early stages," he said, "then, of course, they're going to send you on to some sort of a court where they're going to sort you out, you see. Fortunately," he said, "there was an officer there," he said, "fairly high rank, who appreciated what I was telling him. And," he said, "I was given a chitty, which I carried," he said, "through the war," he said, "whenever any problem cropped up about carrying arms. And I became a medic in the medical corps. And I never carried arms. I never fired a shot all through the war." He said, "I was in Alabama. I was in all of them." He said, "I was a medic." He said, "But I wouldn't carry arms." And that was his story. Remarkable. Anyway, because he's passed away now, I mean, all these people. And so this was just another incident there. So then we were at Bletchley Park, you see. And then we spent the night there. And then the next morning, pulled us back on the train, and we came to Northampton Castle Station and got off there and got onto some lorries. And they brought us up onto Northampton Racecourse. Well, during the war, that had been an army camp. And they left a little piece of the racecourse at the top end, as we call it, Kingsley End, for the public. But the bulk of it was turned into one big army camp. And at different times, there were different units there. I mean, I came home on one leave. Well, I was in England, I came home on one leave. And the 9th Army Division were in the district of Northampton, with squadrons down at different villages, and Brigade HQ was on the racecourse, you see, and the workshops, the army, their divisional workshops were on the racecourse. And it was a massive camp. I mean, the whole of the racecourse was one massive camp, and they got a cinema there which had nearly 2,000 people, and all the things that go basically with a permanent army camp, you see. And I reckon at one time there was about 3,000 or 4,000 ATS stationed on the race, with purely ATS girls, like, you know. And at different times, different units and formations occupied it, and the war gradually went on. Well, then they then turned it into a leaves demob centre, you see, when the war was finished. And what they were doing, they brought us up to the race course in the lorries, debussed off the thing, and put us all in the cinema, and sort of. So they got you on tap, ready for being demobbed. And what they were doing then, the drill hall in Northampton is in Clare Street. And at the back of the drill hall at that time was a large, big field known locally as the Militia Field, you see, because it was, in its early days, the terriers were known as militiamen, you see. And so it got this nickname, which it adopted from the Boer War or sometime, and it was known as the Militia Field. And they'd got a big football pitch there, and it was part of the town football leagues, and sports used to be held there, you see. And the bottom of it, there was a high wall which ran along the side of the racecourse, and where it still is there now. And there's a promenade, so it goes around the racecourse, which is still there, of course, and a line of trees all the way around. And what they did, they knocked a piece of the wall down and put a door where there never used to be one, you see, which meant you could come out of the camp, the racecourse proper, through this door, walk up the militia field, into the buildings of the drill hall and the garages and that, which were there at the top on Clare Street, and that's where you would demob from, you see, where all the suits and all the gear and the money and everything was done. But while you're waiting for that period to come, they stuck you in the cinema on the racecourse, you see, in the camp. And what they were doing, they were showing all these short films, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Popeyes, sort of 5 and 6, 7 minute things, you see, so you could sit there and see one through, or perhaps two or three, you see, before you were taken up to be demobbed. No good putting a film on, which you weren't going to see the beginning or the end, you see. So they put all these little cartoons. And a funny thing happened, because you realise that you've got people by now come from all over the world to be demobbed. And, of course, they weren't all Northampton people. They were going away to all, or wherever they lived, you see. But in my case, I was being demobbed in my hometown. And me and old Jack, we were still together, so me and Jack Smith. And we're sitting there, and there's a chap sitting close by from Burma. Now, you appreciate, he'd been out in Burma for probably five years, away from him, never a chance of a leave of any sort other than perhaps to go into India or somewhere. Certainly not coming home. And you assume this is probably the first time since he was posted out of Burma that he's actually come home. And we're sitting there watching these Mickey Maces and Donald Ducks and that. And suddenly this sergeant comes in and he says, right, you lot here, out you come, up a drill hall, you see. And he'd probably take 20 of you, head of a row. And he got it organised so that as the people kept coming in behind you, he was taking the ones that had come in first to be demobbed, you see. And of course he gets to the point where he picked out a section where I was in to go up to be demobbed, you see, go through the system. And this chap was one of them. And there we are, this chap come from Burma, first time home probably in 4 or 5 years, looking at Donald Ducks and Mickey Mouse's. And this sergeant comes and said, right, you lot, away you come then. And there was all a lot of laughing and joking, you see, like, because it was the tension of the release of everything. And this chap come from Burma and he says, hang on a minute, he said it's nearly finished, I want to see the finish. And I thought, how ridiculous. He's been away from home about 4 or 5 years and he wants to see the finish of a Donald Duck comic thing on the telly before he gets demobbed. I thought, talk about British service humour. You know, it's a typical indomitable spirit of the British soldier. He equates himself with the facts of the situation in hand at the moment. Like, you know, I'll never forget it, this bloke from Burma. Anyway, we went up to the drill hall then, you see, and I don't know the exact how it worked out, but you was going to get a suit and everything, be kitted out and be paid up to date with the paymaster and all that, you see. And I had a bit of luck in one respect, because when you got up there, you see, there's all these, like a tailor's shop, you see, everything there, top coats, macs, caps, berries, caps, trilbies and all sorts of head gear, shoes, boots and everything. And you're sort of let loose to go round and pick out what you want, you see. And there was staff there, civilian staff, who were there to assist you to make sure you got a suit that fitted you and all that sort of thing, you see. And I walks in and I'm just browsing, and suddenly a voice says, hello, Reg. And I turned around, it was a chap named Reg Clark. And he used to work at Crockett's and Jones, where I used to work before the war, you see. So I knew him, he was in the pattern room and I was in the clicking room, but he was an older man than me. So he was going to get called up later in the war anyway. And he hadn't been called into the forces because he got 6 toes on each feet, which I knew about. So before the war, you hadn't got this facility for deformed feet with footwear, you see. So he generally used to have to buy shoes that were much too big for him, you see. And at work, he used to wear a pair of shoes, but he got the sides cut so his toes stuck out each side. But for that reason, they couldn't take him in the forces, you see, because he'd had to have had special footwear. So, of course, he went on to war work. And he was one of the chaps that was there as a guiding hand to see that you got equipped with a suit that fitted you, sort of thing. So he said, "Hello, Reginald, we're talking." So he said, "What have you got your mind on?" So I said, "Well, I thought a decent suit." I said, "And one of them military Macs." I said, "I better have a trilby, I suppose." I said, "Don't want a cap." And so he took me, "See," I said, "Come here, these are good." So, well, the suit I got was a pinstripe jacket, trousers, and waistcoat, because you always had waistcoats those days. And